Okay, Brian, prediction time. What do you think we'll see at CES 2026?
Come on now, this is easy. Self-driving pizza delivery drones.
Okay, I absolutely love that. I was going to say AI-powered fashion shows, but either way, we'll be there co-hosting and you should be too.
CES is where the future gets made in real time, where visionaries and bold thinkers reveal breakthroughs that shape our world.
Every moment sparks innovation and action.
Because when the world is watching,
when the stakes are high,
when the opportunities are real,
innovators show up.
Join us by registering at ces.tech.
See you there.
This is CES Tech Talk. I'm James Kotecki, exploring the trends shaping the world's most powerful tech event, CES 2026 in Las Vegas, January 6th through 9th. The future of American manufacturing, the future of work, the next generation of AI and robotics, all of these trends are coming together on the modern factory floor. And today, we're taking our own private tour of tomorrow. Here to guide us are Ryan Hawk, U.S. Energy and Industrials Leader at PwC, and Dallas Dolan, PwC's U.S. Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Leader. We'll talk about what's really happening on factory floors, how AI and robotics create challenges and opportunities, the reality of workforce investment, and what's behind the next wave of American industrial innovation. Ryan, Dallas, welcome to CES Tech Talk.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Okay, Ryan, Dallas, we really have our work cut out for us in this podcast. There is so much to talk about. So much is happening in factories and manufacturing that we all benefit from and are affected by every day, but not everyone necessarily knows what goes on the factory floor, behind the scenes, so to speak. So, Ryan, let me start with you. Why is this such a key moment for manufacturers? Tell me about the macro kind of pressures and opportunities that you're seeing.
So I think there's a couple of things here. One is, at least in my lifetime, I've never seen the level of optimism that I currently see from manufacturers. Our industry has been one where it's always been a defensive positioning, and it's been razor thin margins and the relentless pursuit of reducing costs. And in some of our recent research, you know, the level of optimism among manufacturing and industrials executives is pretty unprecedented. And so I think there's one factor that this is really our time in industrials, and maybe it's a rare window that we have to build smarter, faster, more resilient operations. And I think what drives that is the convergence of a couple of things. One is, you know, maybe a little bit on policy, you know, and certainly I think tariffs are a catalyst for, you know, maybe people rethinking supply chains and thinking more in terms of cost and capability rather than just cost. I think the other one is what we're talking about here today, which is technology, right? The pace of change is happening at an unprecedented rate, and companies are seeing the optimism in what they could do with their operations. And I think another one is you really can't have those changes in technology without, you know, significant changes in talent. And so when you put all of that together, I think it's creating that level of optimism, and it's a miraculous window. And maybe just to throw out a couple of key statistics. When we did our most recent study of American manufacturers, 9 out of 10 said they think that we're on the precipice of the next big industrial revolution. And 7 out of 10 said that those who don't adapt will be irrelevant within the next 10 years. So there's a lot of action going on. And again, I think it's an era of optimism and being on the offensive.
Wow. So on the precipice of the next industrial revolution, tell us a little bit more about how that looks from your perspective, Dallas. Let's talk about AI and automation, obviously key themes here, and how those are fitting into the economics of where things are made and how things get made. And that's a broad question. Maybe you can just start with, like, if you walk into a factory floor today, like, what am I seeing? If I'm just the average person on the street, am I going to be gobsmacked by the robots and the AI and what's going on behind those doors?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, let me just say, I love it when Ryan says the word technology. When our industrial and industry guy, you know, knows where the real value is being created, that's when you know that I've done my job well. But right, the reality is you can't go anywhere, and I'm not doing my job unless I'm talking about, you know, how tech is influencing every walk of life, and frankly, how AI is actually having a direct impact as well. And fundamentally, there's a couple things that are there, right? You have, first and foremost, the acknowledgement and the experimentation that's happening with AI, whether it's in the back office or it's in the factory floor, and everywhere in between. The amount of power, you know, both compute as well as, you know, perhaps, you know, the innovation that's coming with that mindset going into the robotics that are changing. And that's really changing everything about the way companies will be building things. And Ryan and I had a chance to collaborate on a piece earlier this year talking about the, you know, we'll call it the American revolution, so to say, that could happen if you saw American industrials, you know, reinvesting in robotics and how that could change actually the landscape, not only of manufacturing abroad, but also, you know, play into some of the construct that we've seen play out of the last, you know, 9 months or so of looking at American industries and spending more money to build things here, right? The real capital investment that has to happen. The reality is you pretty much have the vast majority, it's not the majority, it's the vast majority of leadership, you know, whether it's on the manufacturing side or the tech side saying, hey, like we have to own this. And the likelihood of me being out innovated if I do not figure out a way to both use AI in my day-to-day, but also frankly buy the products and have it embedded within it to make my job better, means that I'm probably going to lose. And that's ultimately, I hate to say it, but if being selfish for a second, if you're one of these folks who's, you know, leading a business operation or leading a vertical or leading, you know, leading manufacturing, you know, you can be selfish for a second and say, hey, I have to figure this out and have to figure out how I'm going to use it. Otherwise I'm out and someone else is in. And that's you know, that's not going to be good for anybody.
Ryan, take me onto the factory floor for a second and give me some examples of what we're actually talking about here. I was going to say where the rubber meets the road, but where the cog meets the grease, I don't really know what the expression should be. And that's exactly my point, right? Because if I'm just an average person picturing automated factories, like what I might think of from a movie or something, is that anywhere close to the picture of what I would actually see if I walk these factory floors? What are some examples of the kind of cutting edge technologies we're talking about?
So I think you're looking for where the gears engage if you're in a really pure mechanical engineering perspective. So I think there's certainly, if you take the two parts of this, AI plus robotics, on the robotics front, I think you are going to see all of the things that you would expect to see if there were a movie produced. And I think the qualifier I would give is maybe not at scale. And let me explain a little bit more. So you would see robots doing everything from material handling to assembly operations to machine tending to autonomous machines. And the reason I say maybe you wouldn't see that at the scale that we would all like today, but again, I go back to my level of optimism. I think it's coming, and I think companies are adapting quickly here, is that there are certain limitations, and the limitations range from things like integration with current technologies and manufacturing execution systems and product lifecycle management systems and ERP systems that you just cannot do what needs to be done instantaneously by acquiring a robot. And so there's the technological limitations, but then I also think there's the physical limitations, right? Many of our factories are not configured to allow robots over humans to access certain areas or whatever the case may be. And so you have this interesting thing, I think, of just playing catch up on both the technology integration perspective as well as the physical limitations of putting robots in place. And then if you think about it from an AI perspective, I'm very enamored by this idea of the best plant operator ever. And what I'm getting at there is if you think about what AI could do for operations, you could basically create an operator that knows all of the history, all of the incidents, all of the forecasts, all of the product data, all of the engineering data, all of the manufacturing flows, and be able to recommend things instantaneously that honestly no human today would have the capacity to know all of that, which is why you get this idea of the best plant operator ever. And when you put robotics and that notion of the best plant operator
ever together, I think it's a phenomenal, you know, opportunity. And again, reason for optimism. There's another part to this too, which I guess is also exciting, which is around modularity on plant floors, you know, the ability to have more modular plug and play lines. And again, I'm going to go back to a statistic from the recent study we did, which said that manufacturers expect to be 49% fully modular by 2030. And I think that is a remarkable statistic, because right now the number is less than 10%. And to think that in a fairly short period of time, we're going to become 50% modular in our manufacturing, I think, again, shows that level of optimism, that bias for action around adopting these technologies on the shop floor.
And so that modularity speaks to basically the ability to roll this out faster, right? Because if you're not doing modular, you're talking about something that's custom. And if you have modularity, then you can scale it faster. Is that basically what you're saying?
That's exactly right. And I think the other thing is that you're able to adapt to changing customer needs and specifications and innovation cycles, which is pretty exciting.
Okay, Dallas, let's get right into it now, because the world of AI and technology is no stranger to the question of what is the role of humans in this new world? And we just heard from Ryan this idea of not only machines doing a great job on the factory floor, but potentially doing a great job as the operator as well. So if you've got robots on the floor doing the manufacturing, you've got AI in the back office doing the operating, what is the role of people? We want to talk about workforce investment. I know that's a passionate topic. And what do you think, Dallas? What's the future of people in this world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there was actually a really great article written the other day that made its way around to everybody in my little world, but also frankly made it to my dad. My dad sent it to me, and it was about plumbers using ChatGPT and how it was made them better at their job. And you think about a simple product integration, you know, like that, right? Nothing fancy, none of the modular manufacturing that Ryan's talking about, but how it was allowing, you know, this group of plumbers to not only be better at diagnosing issues, but also at upselling. So actually doing their job to drive revenue. You stop and think about it. Now take that enterprise application and services space, apply it then to manufacturing. And Ryan talked about, you know, having all the history, knowing all the defects. You know, if you have the AI enhanced human, right, who's working on that production line, whether they are in a supervisory role or whether it's an individual who's augmented with some technology, whether it's visual or haptic or otherwise, that also has built into it knowledge of what's happened before and how to avoid those things. I think you absolutely increase the quality of what they're doing. You also probably have a dynamic where the level of fulfillment potentially, you know, for the folks who are doing the work actually becomes incrementally significantly higher, because the person who's doing the work actually becomes significantly more useful, right? You're not simply pressing the Stanley Sprocket's red button that George Jetson was pressing, but you're actually, you know, doing something far more productive and far more engaging. And you are much more intertwined, if you will, in it. So I think the future of engagement, if you will, in the manufacturing process, individuals who are engaged in it actually becomes a much higher engagement, not a lower engagement. The person becomes, frankly, even more valuable. Yeah, maybe you do have fleets and fleets of, you know, robotics in the modular in manufacturing world, something that is exponentially larger, but that human element becomes really critical. And the other thing I'll just mention really quick is I look at this time as being very transitory for not only the technology, like the software itself and what we're seeing in that space and all these LLMs that are being built and the application, you know, questions that exist, but, you know, we are kind of in that like in between world of, you know, what it looks like today when you look out your window or I look out the hotel window that I'm in right now, or you look out, you know, what you see in some sort of futuristic film. Again, you know, whether it's like a Blade Runner type of concept or otherwise, it might be dystopian, but it also could be highly productive, right? Where so much more of the things are not only automated, but they're automated in a way where the human experience throughout it is actually better. And I think that's something that if you apply that directly to the manufacturing space, you see these points that we've talked about, but if you apply that more broadly to society, we are going to move through a transitional period where things move more automatically and more autonomously, whether it's the car that's driving you somewhere or it's the type of vehicle delivering your, you know, your goods, your mail, your food, what have you. all those experiences become, I'll say, quote, better in some respect. It takes friction out of it, but that's going to take some time. And so we will continue to meddle through, if you will, for some period of time between now and, my guess is, probably 2035, 2040, something like that. It's a very long horizon as far as like the real transition for, you know, society around automation.
2035 or 2040, we're going to get Blade Runner out of our windows. Thus said Dallas Dolan on this podcast, and we're going to hold you to that. We'll check back within 10 to 15 years and see if it comes true.
Roger that.
Okay, so let's take the premise then that even with all this AI and automation, we still want and need humans in manufacturing environments. Let's talk about how we train and obtain the right humans to do these jobs, right? Because again, if I'm just thinking about what the average person knows about a factory and what the average person probably pictures as far as a factory worker, certainly a very skilled person comes to mind, but we're talking about, are we talking about a whole new set of skills that folks need to learn? Are we talking about entirely different, you know, kinds of employees or people coming into these environments who maybe in the past wouldn't have considered manufacturing as a career path, but now it makes sense for them and their skills to go into it? I guess I'm just really curious about the workforce component of this and how we think about getting and training these folks. So Ryan, I want to start with you. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think it's a fabulous question. And where I would take it is, I think all elements of work and probably education need to be rethought through. And of course, you know, when you're dealing with the example of the best plant operator ever, what you're really saying is, okay, I still need the human, because the human has to actually trigger the intervention and use good plant or manufacturing or operations or engineering judgment in order to do that. And so you've elevated that, and you're just able to make that decision a lot faster. And so that's probably one level. I think there's another level, which is, how do you interpret the vast amounts of information that are coming at you now, that it can be collected in real time with recommendations made, et cetera? And that's probably more of an upskilling type of scenario. And then I go to my kind of third notion here, which is, we're going to be dealing with engineering problems and engineering designs that, quite honestly, our current engineering curriculums don't necessarily teach. And so, you know, what happens when you get recommendations from, you know, say the best plant operator ever or the best design engineer ever, and you haven't been trained, you know, in thinking about those geometries or whatever the case may be. And so I think this, you know, what happens to humans in this is a very interesting question, because on the one hand, they don't go away. The job absolutely changes. And then you might have to think about how you back that up into our very education system, so that when they, you know, emerge from whatever schooling they've received, they're actually ready to do this work.
Dallas, you kind of teased in a playful way Ryan earlier in this conversation when you said it was nice to hear him from the industrial side talking about technology, which is your world. But does that speak to maybe kind of a deeper reality? I mean, you guys both work for the same company, PwC, but in reality, are there gulfs and gaps between these two worlds that are maybe coming together? And if so, are there still friction points that need to be bridged for this kind of, you know, optimistic future that we're talking about that we want to achieve? I'm thinking about in terms of, you know, workforce is maybe one good example of this, where folks from tech maybe don't see manufacturing or industry as a place for them to go, when in fact, based on this conversation, it would be a fantastic use for their talents. So tell me about the reality of maybe what was behind your kind of statement earlier.
Yeah, James, yes and yes to answer your question. Yeah, there's absolutely, Ryan and my favorite thing happening, which is convergence. And there's absolutely friction to that convergence happening between industries. But this will be a trend that continues. You know, we see it in a lot of platform companies, you know, who also become, in addition to software, their payment companies. You see it in car companies who are energy companies. And you certainly see it in semiconductor companies who are integrating themselves across the supply chain into becoming, you know, part of the software, part of the equation. What's interesting is, and I'll use it maybe analogously to the current market, right? You have a situation where hardware has sort of eaten software from a margin point of view over the last couple of years. That was after basically a quarter century of software eating hardware, you know, from an earnings point of view. And so as the talent and the excitement and the energy literally and figuratively flows into the hardware space, the next question is that exists for all these entrepreneurs and large businesses and small businesses alike, saying, okay, where do I go next? Like, where's the capital flow next? And I think what you're seeing is looking at both, you know, industrials and energy and health and, you know, frankly, also in the pharma life sciences and even the financial services arena, is it's all going, you know, it's all evenly being distributed, so to say, but looking for maybe the high watermark in each one of those things and saying, hey, there's an ability and an opportunity to actually have a real impact, you know, in all these industries and, you know, quote, make things better. And I'll go back to the worker, you know, dialogue that we had a second ago. It's make things better, you know, for the workers and for the consumers of all these products, right? So whether it's making drugs better or whether it's, you know, in making your banking experience more seamless or more enjoyable, certainly more secure, you know, all these technologies are coming in and absolutely doing that. I think net, that's a real positive for the consumer. And for the first time ever, you're seeing, again, back to that word convergence, you're seeing convergence is actually like high value add, to both the purveyor of convergence, so the companies who are deciding to do it, but then also the users are the same. It's not just the same thing as, you know, the brick and mortar store saying, oh, I'm going to go online, I'm going to become an online retailer. That's no longer enough. Convergence actually requires you to really change the business model, reinvent, if you will, you know, what you're doing, and actually move into these new spaces and create value, you know, through your movement into those new spaces. And I think that's something that is, again, really the optimistic person in me is saying, hey, wow, like this is where the net positive comes from everything we're doing. There's some meddling through that'll happen there. But I think the good news is everything that we're doing becomes easier and easier. And I'll just say one last thing, you know, as it relates to training, back to the question you asked Ryan. Now, here's the cool part. Like, people are going to be able to actually make their own lives easier. Even though they're not software engineers, they can write today. You can write code, you know, through natural language prompts to do things on your personal devices, whether it's a phone or a tablet or a computer, that makes your life a lot easier. It just does stuff for you. I do that all the time. I have little agents to do things. I haven't coded since I was in college, which unfortunately was a long, long time ago, but I don't need to, right? And I can do that. I think that's actually the direction of travel for all workers. And that's actually something that also make in high, you know, high degree of improvement to the life of folks who, because they actually have control of what it is that they're doing.
This convergence, this acceleration is happening fast. Ryan, how do you advise leaders to think about investments? When people think about an investment, they want to think about a year, 2 years, 5 years, maybe 10 years down the road, especially if we're talking about physical infrastructure that actually builds things and manufactures things, right? And yet all of this is changing so quickly. So how do you people think about investing in technology, investing in people, and getting it right when things just continue to evolve?
So the time frame and the ROI question is always a difficult one. And I think it comes down to the specific decision and investment being made. But generally, I would say a couple of things. First and foremost, the advice I'm giving is act now. This is not a wait and see moment for people. To your point, the things are happening so fast that things are getting perfected on a daily basis. And those who don't act now will be left behind without a doubt. I think there's a second part of this too, which is focus on the business problems that need to be solved, not the contributing factors. And I think we've seen this era of, well, let's work on data, let's do some AI. Oh my gosh, we need to change our organization. Perhaps we need a CTO. And it's really companies circling around the issue of, well, what problem are you really trying to solve? And so the other bit of advice I give is, let's break this down to the things that are going to truly add value to the company and then figure out how to solve them with technology and the like. And then I think the third part that Ben that allows you to do is address the real issues, which are probably going to come down to technology stack, data, and people. And then my final piece of advice would be, and a CEO actually told me this, it's not original content, but her mantra was, we have to embrace
an attitude of prosperity and abundance. And that is a very different mindset than what manufacturers and industrials have traditionally had, back to my earlier points. And so, you know, going from this mindset of scarcity and getting by to one of prosperity and abundance is not a trivial mindset shift.
Great title for this episode too, Prosperity and Abundance, the Future of Manufacturing. Speaking of prosperity and abundance, one place that really exemplifies that in my mind is CES. And this is the CES Tech Talk podcast, and I'm sure PwC is going to be making its presence known at CES. So question to both of you, what are you looking forward to at CES from the perspective of the conversation that you're having and the ways that it will contribute to the advancement of the dialogue around manufacturing, AI, robotics that we're talking about here? Maybe start with you, Dallas.
Look, CES is exciting. I mean, I've been there a number of times. It is where digital and physical meets, you know, there's all things IoT of the past and where this is all kind of converging, back to that word, but, you know, converging with software and with other industries. And so the great opportunity for leaders to come in, see firsthand what's really going on in AI, what are companies doing with it, how are robotics playing in, how is it affecting different industries, what are their peers doing, back to some of the data that Ryan and I spouted off at the beginning here in terms of, you know, who's doing what and where and how do I prevent myself from falling behind. And the other bit of it, and we're excited about this, is, you know, we hope that, you know, people see some things with all the, you know, events that are going on, and certainly ours, you know, what's happening for people in the tech and industrial space. You know, so they know how to make quick decisions and how they know how to like get ahead of the curve, because there will be something unique about the ease of doing a lot of things that come in the future, which is it's much easier to catch up. And so if you're not moving fast, if you're not first out of the gate, yeah, catching up might be easier, but at the same time, the strategic advantage of being there first is significantly less than it used to be. And I think that's a really big thing for, you know, people also to take away. And we see that every day, by the way, right? In the model performance. It's hard to differentiate. I think that's a really good analogy to the future that we have coming our way.
Ryan, at CES, what are you going to be looking for, whether that's inside the bounds of this conversation or otherwise? Because, of course, CES can be a kind of confluence and a convergence of all different types of industries and technologies that may be relevant to you, you know, next week, or maybe relevant to you 5 years from now.
Yeah, so I think you said it. The thing that I always look forward to at CES is the convergence piece. And, you know, it's most evident, you know, between technology and automotive and industrial manufacturing. But the convergence we're talking about is going to be across multiple industries. And so I'm always excited when I go to CES to see examples of that. And I also get a tremendous amount of inspiration out of CES, even if it's not something that is shown on the floor. I always take something away that is inspiring over the course of the next year.
There you go. As we wrap up here, I want to see if I can get both of your takes on what all of this might look like 10 years from now. So if I could magically connect you with yourself 10 years in the future, what is a question that you would like to ask yourself about robotics and AI and manufacturing as it is in 2035, starting with you, Dallas?
What is it that my kids decided to do, you know, with their careers, knowing that they're coming out of the education system right on that time horizon? And how do they deploy, you know, the skill sets they have, which are pretty good from an academic point of view, but they love building stuff. It's like, were they able to take advantage of what we predicted here? I mean, that would be the most fascinating thing to see. I think that actually affects, candidly, an entire generation of people who are, you know, probably somewhere between middle school and college right now, because that's the workforce that if we're going to be, you know, thinking about impact to, that's the one.
Yeah.
So mine would probably be something along the lines of, I always think of industrials as something patriotic with a little bit of nationalistic flair, right? And as the saying goes, with industrial might comes prosperity and security. And so if I were looking forward 10 years, I would be asking myself, did we reshape U.S. manufacturing with reshoring, autonomous operations, AI-driven factories, et cetera? And have we reestablished our leadership position in that space?
We said we were going to talk about if Blade Runner comes true in 2035, 2040, but I think these questions will be more relevant when we hopefully meet again on this podcast, whether that's in 10 years or next year. It has been great to talk to you, and I do hope that we continue this conversation. Ryan Hawk and Dallas Dolan, both of PwC, thank you so much for joining us. That's our show for now, but there's always more tech to talk about. Be sure to follow, subscribe, like, comment, whatever else you need to do to keep those algorithms happy. You can get even more CES and prepare for Vegas at ces.tech. That's ces.tech. Our show is produced by Nicole Vidovich with Paige Morris and Doug Weinbaum, recorded by Andrew Lin, and edited by Third Spoon. I'm James Kotecki, talking tech on CES Tech Talk.